Talk Shoes.
Recorded live.
Welcome to the Customer Experience Optimization Online Talk Show. Today we have Ingrid Lundberg and myself, Lynn Hunsaker, with an online conversation where we invite everyone to join us just for a look at a specific topic. And today we're talking about customer-centric culture, one of our favorite topics. And this builds on our previous conversation last month on customer experience strategy. We invite everyone to take a look at that recording and also continuing the conversation on the talk show page. Well, Ingrid, welcome this afternoon. How are you today?
I am well, Lynn. How are you today?
Wonderful. Couldn't be better. Today we're going to talk about what customer-centric culture is and what. To start on customer-centric culture, Ingrid?
You know what, Lynn, you cut out right there. Could you try that one more time? I think you had a little bit of a microphone issue for a second.
Oh, yes. What are your perception? What is your answer to people about what customer-centric culture is not? What are some of the misperceptions that are out there?
You know, it's funny that you should ask. I love this idea of customer-centric culture, that we can wave our magic wand and immediately it will happen, right? So there's so many companies that are trying to become customer-centric in this day and age. And I think that one of the biggest challenges that I see those companies kind of running headlong into is just because you say it doesn't mean that it's happening. So many times you see executives decree, we're going to be customer-centric. But what they seem to fail to do more often than not is actually show people what that means, right? So a customer experience centric or customer centric or whatever you want to call it, but a customer culture really isn't one where it's just being mandated or people are just saying you have to do this, because that doesn't actually change the culture. It frankly just makes people run away from it. Right, Lynn?
That's right. I mean, what comes to mind for me is complaints that a lot of employees have about not walking the talk and not putting your money where your mouth is, so to speak, and some posters or a rally or a declaration or even a commitment in the annual report is not enough to say that customers are really the center of your corporate culture.
When you think about that for a second, right? So, I mean, so start thinking about companies, and I do a lot of work with financial institutions, and one of my absolute favorite challenge statements to make to a financial institution when they say, we're customer-centric, and I look at them and I say, so do you still charge fees to your customers all the time, even when you know that they're probably in a really tough spot and they're bouncing a bunch of checks? Do you just keep throwing fee on top of fee on top of fee? Is that what you do to your customers? And there's always this moment, right? There's this moment where someone will sit back and say, wow, you know, we can say that we're truly customer-centric, and yes, we still need to make money. I mean, that goes without saying. But are our policies and are the things that we do in order to make money, are they actually in the best interest of our customer? And I think that's a question that so many companies just need to stop for a second, back up a little bit, and ask themselves. Because if you're making it, you know, if you're overcharging your customers, or if you're making it really difficult for your customers to get what they're trying to do done, then I would challenge that you're probably not very customer-centric. Right, Lynn?
Absolutely. I think that the best rule of thumb is to liken business situations to your personal situations, because it seems that things get skittywampus in business think. And we can think more clearly with personal relationships. So, for example, if you and I are friends and you say that, you know, you're really committed to me and my success, and yet when I'm down and out, you're kind of sticking it to me, I think that that's the essence of what you were just describing. And it doesn't really give me the feeling that you're that into me, you know, or that you're, really that concerned about our friendship and our long-term relationship, does it?
Right. And I think, I mean, how many companies have you seen? You're out there on the B2B side just a ton, Lynn. So how many companies have you had to have that same conversation with where there's a very specific viewpoint that we know we want to be customer-centric, But when the rubber hits the road, you know, it's tough to do. It's really tough to do. I've got thousands of stories, but what's a good one that you have?
Well, my favorite thing about customer centricity is the argument that a lot of people come up with that, gee whiz, if you're going to be customer centric, it means that you have to give everything away for free. Customers are just really unreasonable. And so it doesn't really pay. It's not, it doesn't make good business sense to be customer centric. And I have to say a foul. That's wrong thinking here. What is the purpose of your business? I mean, who is actually funding your business? And when you think of it that way, I think that customers rise to the top in terms of, well, this is the source of our budget, the source of our salaries. And then what people will see is that being customer-centric doesn't mean giving away the store or bending over backward. What it really means is putting customers' interests as your primary priority, and your business and personal interests as maybe your second priority. Do you have a story that you'd like to share?
Oh, goodness. I have so many, Lynn. It's so bad. You know, it's funny because I was just thinking as you were talking about that, about a CFO, a chief financial officer that I worked with, and I've told you this story before, but I think it bears repeating. And we were talking about dollars and cents for some programs that we were trying to put in place for, you know, for the customers. And, you know, they were really basic things, right? It wasn't like we were asking for an arm and a leg. And I'll never forget this guy because he looked at me and he said, well, Ingrid, if you have no money, you have no mission. And I looked at him and I was like, oh, my goodness, you do not understand how this works, right? This is not money driving mission driving customers. This is the other way around, sunshine. So he had to kind of back up a little bit. You know, and I was like, okay, really, there's this whole thing of like no customer equals no cash equals no need to count, no need to count equals no CFO. And sometimes you do just have to remind people. And it's so funny to me because you'd think that this is something everybody gets, right? You'd think that everybody gets that if you don't have customers, you won't be in business. But I go into some of these companies and you really think that they have completely forgotten about that. So, you know, when I talk about culture and I talk about how to help companies become more customer-centric, I spend a lot of time talking about that executive team because that executive team generally is that group that is so far away from what's actually happening with their customers that you've got to spend a ton of time helping them to understand what their customers are actually like in this, you know, in this day and age, because the last time they talked to a customer might have been 30, 40, 50 years ago. Have you seen that, Lynn?
Oh, absolutely. One of the keys here is to keep customers' realities front and center for not only executives and not only your customer-facing groups, but everybody in the company. Even you might consider sharing your customers' realities on a regular basis with your suppliers and alliance partners, channel partner members, and so forth. I think we tend to get too siloed in our thinking about how to share what's important to our customers.
For sure. It's interesting because I've learned just, you know, having been a customer experience officer a bunch of times now and doing lots of work with lots of different companies, one of the toughest groups is, you know, that group that's kind of in the middle of the pack, right? So execs we can talk about for days. I think people who actually talk to customers on a daily basis or a weekly basis, they get it already. It's kind of that home office group, right? The home office group has gotten a little too far away from the reality of the customers that that company serves. And one of the tricks that I have been employing for years is something that I call a customer experience room. And it's a little different than the kind of command center customer room that we've heard about from a lot of people. I really try to create an immersive experience for employees so that they can see what it's like to actually be a customer. You know, the good, the bad, the ugly. And then I also try to show them what we're trying to get to. And I think, you know, one of my favorite examples of this was we were working with a company that had over 1,000, Lynn, 1-800 phone numbers. And we were like, oh, my gosh, how could anybody ever find you, right? And, you know, purposefully, did you purposefully hide yourselves behind all these 1-800 phone numbers? And, you know, just showing the employees and just showing the executive teams how hard it was to do something as simple as finding the right phone number. If I was one of your customers and trying to get a hold of you, how tough that was part of creating a true customer-centric culture, right? Because you have to really let people inside the company see some of the things that you're doing.
Absolutely. Wallpapering the employee's world with customers' realities is really important. And what I mean by realities is not just your success stories and your case studies, your references and so forth, but wallpapering your employee's world with some of the pains that customers are struggling with and some of the solutions that you're working on and the progress that's being made there. Everybody benefits from seeing the whole picture. We put a lot of effort on like a single view of the customer or 360-degree view of the customer, and yet we kind of relegate that to the dashboards that your call centers would have or maybe your salespeople, and we don't really make a 360-degree view of our customer's journey or realities visible to employees at large. So I think that's pretty key. One thing I wanted to point out is that I hear when I'm in the project management world, project-focused or project-driven company, or when I'm in the finance world, I'm hearing finance-driven company and all this stuff. Everybody wants to be driven by whatever their pet topic is. I think the way to do this with customer stuff is to not get stuck in the phraseology of customer focus or customer driven, but to think about centering your business on customers and centering employees on customers. And therefore, it's a customer-centered organization, and that's what we're really getting at is what is the thinking and what is the doing of your people as your day-to-day stuff, your day-to-day efforts go? Is your day-to-day decision-making more emphasized on personal agendas or financial targets or actually customers' well-being? And if that's the nature of your thinking and your doing, then you're on the right track for a culture that is customer-centered. Just some nuances that I had to throw in there, Ingrid.
No, for sure, Lynn. And I think, and we did just get a question, and I want to make sure we touch on that next.
Mm-hmm.
But
yes.
one of the things that I've actually said, and I always feel like I'm getting in trouble when I do it, but I'll go into companies, and you know, they'll hire me, and they'll say, "Hey, can you help us become customer-centric?" And there's been more than one time where I've said, "Okay, well, what is your goal?" Right, and if your goal isn't going to be to do what's best for your customer at every turn, then just go ahead and be innovation-centric or be project-centric or be financially-centric. I mean, you can choose, right? You can choose where you put your focus. And in some cases, I think that it works out just fine. There's a lot of great opportunities or a lot of great examples out there of companies that may not offer the best customer experience, but darn it, they're doing just fine. So it doesn't work for everybody. I think that's something people sometimes forget. So,
well, we got a question here. When conversing with executives to reorient them to a customer-centric paradigm, are there statistics you focus on to show the cost of lost opportunity? That's a really good question because most people are really focused on the revenue upside and they forget the cost of lost opportunity. What are your thoughts, Ingrid?
So I spend most of my time in the B2C world and I do a lot of work on long-term customer lifetime value. Right, so how are we actually going to make more money on a customer? And these are the conversations, right? When I'm doing customer-centric work or customer experience work, it is about head and heart. When you're getting into changing cultures, some people just need a heart pull. Some people need that logical head pull, right? So when you're talking about those execs, you really do need the stats. I spend a lot of time on lost opportunity cost, I spend a lot of time on what's actually happening with your retention and attrition numbers. I spend a lot of time pointing out and showing how one bad experience with one person actually impacts a full ecosystem, which means you may not have access to this entire group of people because you gave one bad experience. And I spend a lot of time really just showing companies, okay, here is the point where you're actually going to start making money with this person. And if you lose them before you get to this point because you have a bad customer experience, your churn is costing you cash. And it's a tough conversation, especially when you don't have a burning platform, right? You may be doing, Lynn, to your point, right? Revenue may be great. All of the sheets may look great. But what you're losing, that lost opportunity cost, when you can actually start to quantify that, that's where you can get a lot more of the heads.
Yeah, I think it's powerful to just take one example of a lost opportunity or even an existing customer and show that what is the ripple effect of things going wrong there or them not feeling like that they're important to the company. But I also like to be more holistic in the definition of lost opportunities. I believe that it's not just about revenue loss, but it's also about the productivity and the precious investments, resources that the company has at hand right now. A lot of what we do because we are self-centric and not customer-centric is wasting a tremendous amount of our people energy as well as our other resources and budget. And if you can pinpoint a few low-hanging fruit things that show the kind of a stupid investments, stupid costs, silly things that we do because we aren't customer focused, that can also be a very powerful statistic to show to executives.
Oh, so right on, Lynn. I one of my absolute favorite moments, and you'll appreciate this so much, I think. I remember I was working with a firm, and we were looking at all of the calls that we weren't able to take and emails we weren't able to respond to because we were only open 8 to 5, Monday through Friday, right? So we had these very short operating hours. Everybody was super comfortable with them. And I sat down and I was like, okay, you guys, look, this is the stupidest rule I've ever found. Why are we only open 8 to 5? There are these thousands of people that try to contact us through different channels outside of this time frame. And it was, you know, it was a pretty big cost to change the company to actually be 24/7 responsive in a multi-channel world. But it was almost instantaneous that we were able to recoup those losses, purely because we were able to serve people at the moment that they needed us. So we helped them make better decisions. They trusted us more. They were more willing to stay with us. I mean, the upside was huge, right? But figuring out that whole ecosystem took some time and a little bit of duct tape and a little bit of hanger wire, I can't lie. But, right, we figured it out. And it was one of those moments where you're like, okay, look, you know, spend a little bit more money, stop making this bad decision. The upside's going to be phenomenal. And the other upside to this was we stopped having to pay out performance guarantees on Mondays because we actually could talk to people when they wanted to call us on the weekend, right? So
I love
simple
it.
Stuff.
Well,
simple
you know,
stuff.
The real upside to those loss opportunities for stupid stuff is that you can rechannel those people and you can rechannel the other resources and funding to more higher value add endeavors. And right there, that can buy a lot of new opportunities. In business to business, I found that there's such a long sales conversation and also a long installation process for certain products that there's sometimes a false sense of close to the customer. We experienced this in the company that I was last at when I was leading customer experience transformation. And we had salespeople and service people on site every day. I mean, they had their office on site at our customer's location. And so when we talked about our core value of being close to the customer. Everyone felt like we certainly were. But I'll tell you what, we got the surprise of our life when the CEO of our top customer stood up in a big meeting and said, "Hey, you guys, I know we're celebrating, we buy a lot from you, but I have to tell you the reason why. It's because you're always first to market, and we have to have the latest technology, and so that's why we buy a lot from you. But I have to be honest that as soon as your executive or your competitors are first to market, we'll be eager to buy from them because, frankly, you're really hard to do business with and you're pretty arrogant, and we're kind of tired of it." Well, this made our executives really shaken to the core, and we decided to set out to do things very differently. And so I was charged with making some major culture changes, or at least helping to drive that in the company. And one of the ways that I think is really powerful to start your culture change to be more customer-centered is to have conversations with various people in human resources, like your compensation and benefits people, your recognition leaders, team recognition and individual recognition, the training organization, the internal communications, and wherever they may be. It wasn't just HR, but I went and talked to marketing, went and talked to finance, and all the different support functions. And we talked about how do we make what they were doing more customer-centered. And we decided to kind of take baby steps, but to do that in a company-wide way so that whatever we were doing, we might have piloted somewhere a little bit, but quickly to try to make it consistent company-wide. And the baby steps meant that quarter by quarter or year by year, we were adding more sophistication to being customer-centered in what our support functions were doing. And that was a mirror image of what we were asking our people in the P&Ls, the product lines, and the regions to do to actually fix chronic issues that customers had. And this was our recipe to become more customer-centered. What's another way besides the great ideas that you've given out so far, Ingrid, for people to get started in customer-centered?
You know, so I think, Lynn, one of the things that I love to do, and this is such an easy trick, right? It's such an easy trick. I find something that is a decision or a project or something that was funded that clearly isn't customer-centric. And I stop it, and I make sure that we celebrate stopping it, right? So that's an easy, big one, because you're sending a very clear message to the company. That's that getting beyond just the lip service piece of it, right? Mm-hmm. We're going to stop doing this thing that we know isn't really core to whatever our new mission is. So that's number one. Number two, I tend to play a lot of games. I try to make these things as fun as they possibly can be. So I do things. One of them is I call it the stupid rules contest. And I, you know, will ask all the employees, please tell us what processes, procedures, and rules are out there that are stopping you from being able to serve our customers. And it is hysterical, some of the stuff that you find, right? I mean, you'll find things that have been in place for 20 years that nobody even knows that you're requiring people to do anymore. That's just so archaic and so horrible. And you stop them. We've had funerals for stupid rules. We've had burning contests for stupid rules. But you really get rid of those things and you celebrate the people who find them. I think that's a big one. And then the third one that I think is really, really key is you have to be able to find and celebrate the employees who are taking the chance to do what you're asking of them. Because a lot of cultures, you know, it's probably, we can say that we're customer-centric, but you know that if you break the rules, that you might get fired. And one of my favorite stories about this is, it's a JetBlue story, and my friend Bonnie used to tell it all the time, where one of the employees actually figured out a way to get a woman from coast to coast on a JetBlue airline and pretty much gave her the entire airline because she had had this horrible, horrible, horrible accident and needed to be flat. And it was one of those things where you hear the story about this woman who figured out how to pretty much charter a plane for a human, right? Should have gotten her fired, didn't get her fired. ended up putting her in a pretty senior executive position because at the end of the day, she did the right thing for that customer. You know, and we hear story after story about these cultures where it's really, you know, Ritz-Carlton gives everybody $1,000 to, you know, do good things for the customers. It's more important to find those companies that really it's not celebrated yet and find one of those employees who is willing to take a risk, do the right thing, and then you celebrate the heck out of them.
Well, I love all of that. I found that for being customer-centered, it's better to be more proactive than to be reactive, as much as we do need to save the day on, you know, dire situations. I really love the examples you gave. What we used at my last company, and I've done this with other many of my clients, set up a team recognition system where you have the criteria spelled out for different categories, for example, resolving something, being more attuned to the next process. If you're back, one of the back office people at the home office, you know, you have internal customers as well. So having different categories for different types of employees and different types of situations where you have the criteria well defined, and then teams work toward submitting their progress on something, and they post it up on an intranet site that you have for this, and then you have executives to review it and give constructive feedback. And if the teams did not meet the threshold for winning the recognition that quarter, they can go back and take that constructive feedback, work on it further, and submit it again in a future quarter. I found that this type of recognition goes a long way to teaching people a different way of thinking and a different way of doing in the company so that they leave behind those old habits and take on a more customer-centered approach in what they do. And it spills over into the things beyond the specific projects. It spills over into the psyche of the company. Hey, Ingrid, we got another question. How do we encourage behaviors across the company to encourage listening to customers and channels to improve processes in the B2B space? Well, I think this also goes to the top again. If the top executives are demonstrating curiosity about customers, they're demonstrating, hey, I wonder why this, or I wonder what that about, or they're, you know, really intrigued by anything that customers are saying, that will go a long way to paving the similar behaviors of curiosity with the rest of the employees. I think that when people don't want to listen to what customers are saying, but they think they already know, that's where we really trip up. That's where we become conceited. We become out of sync with what customers need from us, and we run into the vulnerability of losing business. So nurturing a curiosity climate, I think, is really important to keep going. I kind of think about the mode that you're in when you're first falling in love with somebody, or you're first falling in love with maybe even a hobby. You can't get enough of it. You got to read. You got to ask questions. You want, you know, how is this for you? How is that for you? And that kind. And then you hear experts give advice. How do you keep these things fresh? How do you keep that relationship fresh? How do you keep your passion for your hobby fresh? And it all boils down to a sense of curiosity, a sense of kind of wonderment about the other party. And that's what we need to think about doing in a constructive way. It works for your culture. One of the other things I do want to point out before we finish here is that change management templates are really important to use when you're trying to nurture a customer-centric culture. You can use change management templates to assess different groups in the company, figure out what's in it for them, what's holding them back, what kind of habits they have, what kind of systems are in place that are working at odds with a customer-centered mindset. And those kinds of templates, if you use them with your customer experience management team, can go a long way in charting a course for building that customer centricity. What are your observations, Ingrid? Anything to add there?
No, I think that plus just remembering that this is also a marathon, right? We talked about customer experience strategy last week. There's two components to it. One is the cultural transformation. One is the business transformation. The cultural transformation can take just as long as the business transformation. So give yourself time, write it down, put it out there for everyone so everyone knows where you're going, and off you go. And with that, we are at 3:30. Lynn, how did we do this again?
We are. We do have one last question that came in. Do we dare take it on? It says, are there any specific metrics beyond cost of acquisition and time to profit that I can provide to execs and can help provide a huge wow factor?
I'm a big fan of attrition. Attrition's a big one.
Yep, turnover of your customers. I think turnover of employees can be added to that to see the whole picture, because there's a lot of these stupid things we've been talking about, not only cost in lost revenue, but also cost in additional expenses to get new customers, to replace the old customers, and they cost in lack of productivity and low morale and so forth inside the company. So,
lots of legs to that one, right?
Lots of legs to that one. That's a quick answer. Well, we want to thank everybody for joining us today. I see that we still have a rabid appetite in our question bin here.
You know what? Maybe this will be our next talk show. How's that, Lynn?
All right. So why don't we go ahead and take the next questions for next month, and maybe we'll move this up a little bit earlier. But we want to thank everyone for joining us in the Customer Experience Optimization online conversation. And please do continue the conversation on the talk show page, and we'll be glad to answer your questions going forward. And best wishes to you in optimizing customer experience.